Right now, orbiting hundreds of miles above your head, there's this 6.7 billion euro machine, and it actually knows more about your local environment than you do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it knows the exact temperature of the ocean off your coast, the health of the crops in your state, you name it.
Yeah, it even knows whether the ground beneath your house shifted by like just a single millimeter yesterday.
Yeah.
And the wild thing is, you never interact with it directly.
No, never. But it still governs everything from the price of your groceries to the exact route your airplane takes.
It's crazy. We live in this world that's basically governed by invisible architecture. People expect high-resolution, real-time data about the environment, the same way they expect water to flow when they turn on the tap.
Right, but the sheer scale of the engineering required to keep that data flowing is something most of us just never see. We take it completely for granted.
We really do. So today, we are taking a deep dive into that invisible architecture. We're pulling from a massive, up-to-the-minute Wikipedia article detailing the Copernicus program.
Which is the European Union's Earth Observation Initiative. It is a massive ongoing effort.
Huge. We are going to look at its history, the hardware it currently has in orbit, its ground operations, and the really intense freezing boots-on-the-ground testing happening right now, this month, in April 2026.
Yeah, our mission here is to show you how a network of satellites and ground sensors became the ultimate real-time health monitor for our planet. We're going to break down how this free data actually impacts your everyday life.
And we'll explore why hundreds of scientists are currently braving the Arctic just to ensure the next generation of space lasers actually work. So, welcome to the deep dive. And just to be clear up front, we are not just talking about dry bureaucratic space policy today.
Definitely not. It is so much more dynamic than that.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because when I was looking through the sources, the scale of Copernicus was honestly pretty hard to wrap my head around. The best way I could process it was to stop thinking of it as, a giant telescope pointing down at us. It's actually more like a smartwatch for the entire planet.
I really like that. The smartwatch analogy holds up surprisingly well when you look at how the architecture is designed.
Right, because the smartwatch tracks all these independent biometrics, heart rate, sleep, oxygen, and then it synthesizes them into an overall health score.
Exactly. And Copernicus does the exact same thing, but it uses six main interacting themes. So you have atmosphere, marine, land, climate, emergency, and security.
So it's constantly taking the Earth's vitals across all those areas.
Continually. But to understand how it pulls that off, you really have to look at its three pillars. So there's the space component, the in-situ measurements, and the services component.
And that services component is where things get really wild for me. Because the foundational philosophy of Copernicus is that the data is completely free.
Totally open source. Anyone, anywhere in the world can just access it.
Which is great, but building and launching satellites is brutally expensive. I mean, the source data shows that between 1998 and 2020, this entire system cost an estimated 6.7 billion euros.
Yeah, it is a massive public investment.
So why on earth would the European Union spend billions to build a planetary smartwatch, only to just give the data away to anyone who asks? Like, where is the return on that?
Well, because treating the data as a free public utility creates this massive economic ripple effect. By opening the floodgates, the EU allows downstream services, so startups, researchers, agricultural firms, to build highly profitable tools on top of that raw data.
Oh, I see. So the government takes the upfront infrastructure cost.
Exactly. And the projected benefits to the EU economy alone are actually estimated at 30 billion euros through 2030.
Wow. Okay, so if I'm understanding this, it's a lot like providing free GPS data, right? The government built the GPS satellites, but making that data free is what allowed companies to build ride-sharing apps, food delivery logistics, all that stuff that generated trillions in economic value.
That is a brilliant comparison. That's exactly how it works. Let's look at a concrete example with Copernicus, just to ground it. Imagine an agricultural tech startup. They take free Sentinel-2 satellite imagery, which maps soil moisture and vegetation health down to a 10-meter resolution. It's incredibly detailed.
10 meters, so they can literally see individual plots on a farm.
Yes. So the startup takes that raw data, runs it through their own proprietary algorithm, and they sell a simple, easy-to-use app to farmers.
Right, because the farmer doesn't want to look at raw, multispectral satellite data.
Exactly. They just want to know what to do. So the farmer looks at their phone and sees exactly which corner of their field needs watering today and which part needs fertilizer.
That's amazing.
The farmer saves thousands on water and chemicals, the startup makes a profit on the app, and the overarching economy grows. And all of that happened because the initial space data was free.
The ultimate public good driving private innovation. I love that. But a smartwatch needs physical sensors, right? Let's talk about the space component you mentioned earlier.
Right, the hardware.
Yeah, because the sources detail this whole fleet of dedicated missions called the Sentinels, which were built by the European Space Agency. And here I actually have to push back a little bit on the whole concept.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, we have NASA, we have private companies launching rockets, every other week now? The sky is getting totally crowded with commercial imaging satellites. Why did Europe need to spend billions designing and building six entirely new families of Sentinel satellites? Aren't there enough cameras up there already?
It is really easy to look up and think the sky is just saturated with cameras. But what's fascinating here is the fundamental difference between a commercial camera and a highly calibrated scientific instrument.
Okay, how so?
Well, private companies launch satellites to serve paying clients. Their sensors might change from one launch to the next, their orbits might shift based on customer demand, or frankly, the company might just go bankrupt.
Right, they are beholden to the market, not to science.
Exactly. So if you are a climate scientist tracking sea level rise or global deforestation over a 30-year period, a patchwork of private, constantly shifting data is basically useless.
Because you lose your baseline. You can't compare a photo taken by some commercial startup today with a highly specific radar measurement taken 10 years ago by a different machine.
You completely lose the continuity. Europe recognized they needed autonomous, standardized, and uninterrupted data streams. That was non-negotiable.
So they built the Sentinels to be these dedicated public servants.
Yes, and each family is armed with a highly specialized capability. They aren't just taking regular photos. Take Sentinel-1, for instance. It doesn't use optical cameras at all. It uses synthetic aperture radar, or SAR.
I really want to dig into that because the physics of SAR are incredibly cool. It's not looking at light at all, right?
And even a little bit.
It's actively firing microwave pulses down at the Earth and just listening for the echo to bounce back.
Which gives it an incredible advantage over a regular camera. Visible light is easily blocked by weather. That means standard optical satellites are effectively blind over cloudy areas or, obviously, during the night.
Right, half the planet is in darkness at any given time.
Exactly. But Sentinel-1's radar cuts right through dense storm clouds and operates perfectly in pitch-black conditions.
So if there's a disaster, it doesn't matter what the weather is doing.
That's the key. If an earthquake triggers a massive landslide or a hurricane causes catastrophic flooding, emergency responders cannot wait around for a sunny day to see the damage. Sentinel-1 measures the time and phase of the returning radar waves to map ground shifts down to the millimeter, regardless of the weather.
It totally shifts the paradigm from just taking a picture to actually performing a physical measurement. And then you have Sentinel-2, which does use optical imaging, but the sources call it high-resolution multispectral, which means it's seeing colors the human eye can't even process.
Yes, it is measuring very specific wavelengths of light, particularly in the near-infrared spectrum.
Why near-infrared?
Because healthy plants reflect a massive amount of near-infrared light due to their chlorophyll structure. So by comparing the visible red light a plant absorbs with the near-infrared light it reflects, Sentinel-2 can essentially see the photosynthetic health of a forest or a farm all the way from orbit.
That is wild. And then Sentinel-3 is monitoring ocean temperatures, and Sentinel-6 is doing this incredibly precise radar altimetry, bouncing pulses off the ocean surface and timing their return to the microsecond just to measure sea level rise.
It's a comprehensive suite of tools, and they aren't just launching one of each either.
Right. The sheer volume of hardware they are putting up is staggering. The sources outline a deeply aggressive launch schedule just over the last year or two to keep this whole constellation fresh.
The logistics of maintaining that baseline we talked about require constant replenishment. They fly them in pairs or constellations to ensure they revisit the exact same spot on Earth very frequently.
Just looking at the operational tempo recently, it's intense. In December 2024, they launched Sentinel-1C, and then 2025 was just a marathon.
It really was. We saw Sentinel-4A go up in July to monitor atmospheric trace gases. The very next month, in August 2025, Sentinel-5A launched for even broader atmospheric tracking.
And they didn't slow down. Sentinel-1D went up in November. And that was followed literally days later by Sentinel-6B in mid-November.
Launching multi-ton scientific instruments back-to-back like that, it proves this isn't just a launch-it-and-forget-it science experiment. It is treated as critical infrastructure.
Absolutely. But Here is the vulnerability I see with this entire setup. Satellites drift. Space radiation degrades delicate instruments over time.
That's true. It's a harsh environment.
So going back to our smartwatch analogy,
yeah.
If my watch says my heart rate is 200 beats per minute, but I'm just sitting on the couch reading a book, I don't inherently trust the watch. I stop and check my own pulse physically.
Right. You need a reality check.
Exactly. If Copernicus is gathering all this data from hundreds of miles away in the vacuum of space, how do we know the satellites aren't just lying to us because a sensor degraded?
You have to double check the pulse. This is the absolute necessity of the second pillar of Copernicus, which is the in-situ data. In-situ literally means in position.
So on the ground.
Yes. Without ground truth, space data is really just an educated guess.
But what does that ground truth actually look like? Are there like European Union Copernicus agents walking around with thermometers in fields?
Not exactly agents, no. It is a massive decentralized network of thousands of sensors all over the world. We are talking about weather stations bolted to the sides of freezing mountains, commercial airplanes equipped with atmospheric sniffers just flying their normal routes.
Wait, commercial planes have sniffers on them?
Oh yeah, lots of them gather data while they fly passengers around. Plus, you have cargo ships taking automated water samples as they cross the Pacific, and thousands of autonomous buoys floating in the deep ocean sinking and rising to measure salinity profiles.
And all of those physical earthly measurements are constantly being fed into the same servers as the satellite data.
Exactly. They are continuously assimilated into these complex forecasting models to calibrate the algorithms.
How does that work in practice?
Well, say Sentinel-3's orbital sensors calculate that the surface temperature of a specific patch of the Atlantic is exactly 15 degrees Celsius based on the thermal radiation it sees.
Okay.
But a physical buoy floating right there in that exact spot registers the water at 14.2 degrees. The system uses that in-situ reality check to adjust and correct the satellite's math. It is a relentless, ongoing loop of calibration.
It's a massive global teamwork exercise.
Yeah.
And the sources note that Copernicus doesn't even own all these ground sensors or auxiliary satellites, right? They rely really heavily on what they call contributing missions.
Yes. They basically plug in data from private companies and international partners to fill in the gaps.
Which seems like a smart way to do it.
It's highly pragmatic.
Yeah.
Why reinvent the wheel if someone else has already built a specialized spoke? The sources actually highlight a German commercial provider called Auroratech as a perfect example of this.
What does Auroratech do?
They operate a constellation of thermal infrared satellites that are built specifically to detect the early heat signatures of wildfires.
Oh, that's incredibly useful.
It is. So Copernicus integrates that proprietary data into its own ecosystem. That instantly upgrades its emergency management capabilities, and the EU didn't have to design, fund, and launch a dedicated wildfire satellite from scratch.
Which is a brilliant way to save money, because funding a space program of this magnitude is a pretty precarious geopolitical tightrope.
Huh?
I mean, you have dozens of nations pooling resources to build these machines.
And geopolitics can definitely get in the way of science.
Right. The sources actually mention a major financial hurdle that nearly derailed the entire next phase of the program. After Brexit, the UK exited the Copernicus program, taking a massive chunk of the expected funding with them.
Building high-tech space architecture requires deep, long-term capital commitments. You can't just pause half a satellite. The UK's departure created a severe funding shortfall.
But they managed to resolve it. The sources emphasize that in October 2024, the UK formally re-entered the initiative.
Yes, and that was far more than just a diplomatic reset. The influx of British capital returning to the program was the critical lifeline needed to secure the manufacturing and deployment of the next major evolution of Copernicus.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because that renewed funding brings us exactly to where we are today, in April 2026.
The expansion phase.
Right. We've established that Sentinels 1 through 6 are up there tracking everything from ocean heights to crop health. If we already have this comprehensive planetary dashboard, what could we possibly be missing that requires the ESA to design and build Sentinels 7 through 12?
It's a great question. Basically, we are shifting from broad environmental monitoring into the realm of targeted policy enforcement.
Policy enforcement. Like space cops.
Sort of. The current Sentinels are excellent at showing us the general health of the Earth, but as international climate treaties become stricter, generalized data just isn't enough anymore.
We need specifics.
Exactly. We have glaring gaps in our ability to actually police those treaties. The Copernicus Sentinel expansion mission Sentinel 7 through 12 are engineered to solve very specific, urgent blind spots.
I get tracking ice and oceans, But as regulations tighten, let's be real, governments and corporations are absolutely going to start fudging their emissions numbers to avoid penalties.
Mm-hmm.
How can a satellite possibly police a specific factory's carbon output from space?
You have zeroed in on perhaps the most critical expansion mission of all of them, Sentinel-7, which is known as CO2M.
CO2M. Okay, what does it do differently?
Well, currently, we can measure the general concentration of carbon dioxide in the global atmosphere. But CO2 gets mixed up by the wind really quickly, and it is naturally absorbed and released by forests and oceans all the time.
Right, the natural carbon cycle is huge.
Right, so if a country claims they reduced their emissions this year, it's actually very hard to prove them wrong from orbit using current tech.
So how does CO2M change the game?
By tracking the fingerprints of human activity. CO2M is designed to specifically identify anthropogenic, so human-made CO2 plumes.
How does it tell the difference between a forest breathing and a factory burning coal?
It does this by measuring CO2 simultaneously with nitrogen dioxide, or NO2.
Oh, interesting. Why NO2?
Because NO2 is a highly localized, short-lived gas produced almost exclusively by burning fossil fuels. It doesn't stick around long enough to mix into the global background noise.
So it's like a tracer dye.
Exactly. By mapping the NO2 plumes directly back to their source, say a specific coal power plant or a massive traffic grid in a megacity, and combining that with high-resolution CO2 measurements, Sentinel-7 will separate human pollution from the natural carbon cycle.
So it literally sees the invisible exhaust pipe. That is an absolute game changer. You are talking about an independent, undeniable audit of global emissions. No more relying on self-reported spreadsheets from factories.
It takes the guesswork entirely out of the equation. Yeah. And then looking at the poles, we have Sentinel-9, known as Crystal.
Right, for the ice.
Yes. As the Arctic and Antarctic warm at an accelerated rate, just knowing the two-dimensional spread of sea ice isn't enough anymore. We need to know its actual volume.
How thick it is.
Precisely. Crystal uses a dual-frequency radar altimeter to measure the precise thickness of the sea ice and, crucially, the depth of the snow resting on top of it. This is critical for predicting global sea level rise and ocean circulation patterns over the next century.
But, you know, building these hyper-advanced radars and lasers in a sterile clean room in Europe is one thing. Making sure they actually interpret the ice correctly from space is another.
That's the hardest part.
Which brings us to the irony of the scientific method here. The sources detail an event happening right now, this very month, in April 2026. The ESA hasn't just launched the satellites, they've sent an entire army of scientists up into the freezing Arctic.
Yes, the CEMSI campaign, the Copernicus Expansion Mission's sea ice experiment. It really highlights the brutal reality of that in-situ calibration we talked about earlier.
It sounds freezing.
It is. Teams from the European Space Agency, NASA, and various universities are currently deployed in the extreme cold of the Arctic. They aren't just sitting comfortably in labs analyzing data. They are physically out on the sea ice.
So they're building multi-million euro space sensors, but they still have to send human beings out to freeze on an ice floe with an auger drill just to make sure the math works.
That is exactly the reality. They are literally out there taking physical core samples of the snow and ice. And simultaneously, while they do that, they are flying specially equipped aircraft overhead.
Carrying what, like test radars?
Yes, carrying prototype radars and radiometers that mimic the exact instruments that will eventually be on Crystal and another expansion mission called CIMR.
Okay, so they fly over the scientists on the ground.
Right, and by comparing the airborne radar readings with the physical measurements taken by the scientists standing right there on the ice, they can refine the algorithms perfectly. They are enduring sub-zero temperatures today, so that when the satellites launch in the coming years, their data will be instantly reliable.
That is incredible dedication. So, bringing this all back down to Earth for a minute. Why should you, the listener, care about scientists freezing in the Arctic or synthetic aperture radars or a bunch of acronyms orbiting the Earth?
It's a fair question.
Because this data is actively shaping the world you live in right now.
Yeah.
When your city council maps out where to build a new flood wall to protect your neighborhood, they're relying on Sentinel elevation data. When international bodies sign treaties to reduce emissions, they're going to use Sentinel-7 to verify if those politicians are actually keeping their promises.
Copernicus isn't just taking pretty pictures of clouds. It is providing the undeniable baseline facts that will dictate how humanity navigates the next century of climate change.
It acts as the ultimate impartial reality check for our species.
It really does.
To summarize what we've unpacked today,
mm-hmm.
Copernicus is an unprecedented open-source dashboard for Spaceship Earth. Born from a necessity for autonomous environmental monitoring, It has evolved into a massive economic engine, generating billions of euros by letting anyone, anywhere, build tools using its data.
A truly open system.
Exactly. It's a system where space-based radar and optical sensors are constantly interrogated and verified by ocean buoys, mountain weather stations, and scientists drilling into Arctic ice.
And as we look toward those expansion missions, I want to leave you with a final thought to consider. We are crossing the threshold into an era of radical transparency.
Radical transparency.
Yes. Historically, environmental destruction, say, illegal logging in the deep Amazon, a factory venting toxic gas at night, or a nation secretly burning coal could be hidden by geography and plausible deniability. You just couldn't prove who did it.
Right. It was their word against yours.
But now that humanity has built this free, real-time, high-resolution monitor showing the chemical makeup of our atmosphere and the daily shifts in our landscapes, the excuse of ignorance is entirely gone.
Wow. That's true.
If an investigative journalist, a small startup, or just an everyday citizen can independently pull down satellite data showing the exact source of a CO2 plume, how will this unavoidable transparency change how we hold power accountable in the next 10 years?
That is a staggering realization. Plausible deniability is going extinct because the data belongs to everyone. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. If you want to see the health of the planet for yourself, I highly encourage you to look up the Copernicus Data Space ecosystem online.
It's free to use.
Yes, you can literally access the pulse of the Earth right from your browser. And the next time you glance at your phone and see a weather alert or an air quality warning, remember, you aren't just looking at an app. You are looking through the eyes of a sentinel, keeping watch from the dark.